We will start. What I want to do is conflate last week's shiur, which didn't happen, and this week's. And I want to share with you some key insights in the parshiot that the Rav gave from in the parshiot of Lech Lechan Vayera. What we'll do is I'll give you some. I'm going to give some pointed, some sort of specific points, and then we'll talk a little bit about Avraham Avinu as a persona, as a figure. Now it happens to be a couple of years ago, a collection of the Rav Shiurim about Avraham Avinu was published. The collection is called Journeys. Some of what I'm going to tell you actually is there, although. Most of what I'm telling you is even if it is there, it came from things that I heard myself or from my own notes. I really recommend the book, though. It's really well done. When you have the opportunity to... you should be, by the way, you should know that, of course, that when it comes to Sifrei, of course, with Sifrei Kodesh, Sifrei Chol, or books in English, are a little more expensive here in Israel, but Sifrei Kodesh, if you plan to get stuff, Israel's place to do it, it's a fraction of the cost. All right. Anyways, I love spending other people's money having to buy books. Anyways, let's open your chumashim. I want to zero in on a couple of important points that I think are two important points. One from this week's parsha, one from next week's parsha. One from last week's parsha, one from this week's parsha. That I think are very central pieces of the Rav's. Thought and are quite actually quite they're actually quite beautiful as well. We're going to start with Bereishit Perikud Bet Halacha Pasuk Aleph. Vayomer Hashem el Avram Lech Lecha Me'artzecha Mimulatecha Mibeit Avicha El Aretz Asher Areka Ve'Esecha LeGoy Gadol Vavarecha VaGadla Shemecha VaYei Bracha. This part we all know. Avraham Avinu is told to leave Eretz Canaan, to leave his father's house, and so on and so forth. Okay, he leaves. He takes his wife Sarai. He takes Lot, his nephew, and all of their wealth, and all of their retainers, and all of the people that were part of it. Avraham Avinu was a sort of wandering sheikh. He wasn't just the guy in a mobile home, right, with his immediate family. He's a power. He's a personality. He has wealth. He has armed retainers. He had 300, according to the Pshat. He had a small army, a little militia of 300 men. Keep in mind, by the way, there were not 300 men on the field at Lexington and Concord, okay, in 1775. So 300 men is not a small army. And Avraham Avinu has that. He can get them all ready to go chase after the kings and pull a guerrilla action to be able to save. To save Lot in last week's parsha. Anyway, and he comes to Eretz Canaan, and he comes to Shechem, and he comes to Elon Moreh, and so on. All is very nice, and God appears to him and says, "This is where you were supposed to be. Okay, this is the land I'm giving you." And then he made a mizbeach. Avraham Avinu makes a lot of mizbechot. Every time God appears to him, he makes a mizbeach. It's a time before, instead of making like a little sign saying, I don't think the mizbeach actually said that this altar was built and donated by Abraham Terechson and his wife Sarai, and they didn't have children at the time, as might happen to his among his descendants. But everywhere he goes, he makes a mizbeach, because the truth of the matter is that Avraham Avinu, as we will see when we talk about the Rambam, was on a mission from God, not just to move to Eretz Israel, but he was God's advance man. His function was to spread the belief in the one God, which was really, really out of step. It was extremely politically incorrect to go around and to say that all the gods are nothing and there's only this one God who you've never heard of, who is the one God. That didn't make him a lot of friends, didn't influence a lot of people, certainly not positively. Nevertheless, he's going around and setting up he's not just on a mission from God, he's also setting up altars to, in a certain sense, establish the worship of the one God. So anyways, he comes to Shechem and he builds, you know where Shechem is, everybody?
Yeah.
Okay, Shechem is here. He's coming down, I assume, what is today Route 60, which is called the Road, because it goes down the middle of the country,
and ends up coming to Yerushalayim. Route 60 cuts across the hill country in the land of Israel, and ultimately goes first to Shechem, and from Shechem goes on to Damascus. That's why the gate in the Old City is called in Hebrew Shar Shechem, and in English Damascus Gate, because it is a point on that road, Route 60, which in fact goes north. So he's coming down Route 60. First he hits Shechem, which is right here, and then he keeps going south, okay, towards Jerusalem.
I was actually near Shechem Jews aren't allowed to go into Shechem because it's run by the Palestine Authority. But I was actually in Har Gerizim with the Shomronim on Chol Hamoed. It was really cool. That was just opened up on top of Har Gerizim are a couple of ancient cities, a Roman city and a Byzantine city, and there are even earlier remnants. And it overlooks the entire area of Shechem. You can see Har Eival, Gerizim and Har Eival, where the Bracha and the Klala were set up in the time of Yoshua. Well, the truth is, in the Chumash already it says that the six tribes will be on Har Eival to hear the Klala, and six tribes will be in Har Gerizim to hear the Bracha. Interestingly, Har Eival, nothing grows on it, because that's the Har Klala. They found on Har Eival a Mizbeach, an altar, which many archaeologists think actually was built by Yoshua ben Nun, because it's a Mizbeach that has no non-kosher animals, and the dating is about the time of Yoshua, and it can only be Jews. The only Mizbeach that we know of would have been that of Yoshua. In any event, what I never understood is how can you have six tribes on one mountain and six tribes on another mountain, and they'd have the Kohanim and the Levim in the valley, and you hear what they're saying, because according to when Chumash, Rami says Arura Sher Yita, you know, Yaseh Pesel Mechecha Masecha, and they say Amen and so on and so forth. But it turns out, I asked the actually Shomroni there, and he said that they can hear everything that goes on in Shechem, which is in the valley. So the acoustics is such that if you're on top of the mountain, you can hear everything that goes on. So if you had a whole bunch of, like a large crew of Levites or Kohanim, I forgot already at the moment who did it, giving brachot, you could actually hear it. So it's not the acoustics were such, it's actually, you don't need, like, you know, PA systems and stuff like that. In any event, so he goes to Shechem. Then he leaves, Vayet, take me sham hahara, mikedem lebeit el, vayeto halo, beit el miyam va'ay mikedem, vayivan sham mizbeach, vayikra b'shem Hashem. He kept wandering south, and he makes it to Beit El, which is ancient Beit El is approximately... Well, it's near Beit El. Beit El is here. Okay? Modern day Beit El, which is just slightly north of Yerushalayim, also on Route 60, is in fact right next to the ancient site of Beit El. So that's exactly where he was. Beit El Miyam Ba'ai Mikedem means he was between here and here. I was approximately here, so he's on right on the road. Right off the road, he builds another Mizbeach. Okay? And then the Torah says, Vayisa Avram halokh v'nasa'u hanegba. He's going halokh v'nasa'u hanegba, keeps going continually south. Now, according to the pshat, what he's doing is he's sort of checking out the country. He started in the north and he's going south. He wants to check out this piece of the property that God had promised him. But Rashi says something even more, says something which is almost, it was difficult to understand. He says, Vayisa Avram halokh v'nasa'u hanegba. He says, Lifrakim. He would go in stages. He'd go Yoshev Khan Chodesh, he would stay one place for a month, or Yoter, or maybe more than a month, Venosea, Misham, and he'd keep going, Venotero, Alobi Makom Acher, and he'd pitch his tent somewhere else. And then Rashi adds, okay, so that Adkan is Pshat. Simple meaning, that's what he was doing. Halok Venosoa, he kept moving. You're moving with a whole caravan, so it takes time. V'chol Masa'av HaNegba, says Rashi, all of his wanderings, all of his travels, ever in a southern direction, lalechet lidroma shel eretz Yisrael, he was kept pushing towards south in Yerushalayim, v'hi letzad Yerushalayim, it's south of eretz Yisrael, sorry, v'hi letzad Yerushalayim, shu b'chelko shel Yehuda shenitalo bedroma shel eretz Yisrael har Moriah shenachlato. He kept going towards Yerushalayim, ultimately leading towards Har Moriah, ultimately leading to the Temple Mount. Okay, so later on, Har Moriah will become a very important part of his life personally, because that's where what? Akedat Yitzchak, the Temple Mount, is where Akedat Yitzchak took place. Okay, we'll talk about that in a little bit. Okay, so far so good. Now, the question is, that's not what the Pasuk says. The Pasuk says that he was going southward. That's all. So what? Maybe he wanted to go to Be'er Sheva. He ends up settling in Be'er Sheva too. I mean, you know, you don't think about, when you think about Avraham Yitzchak and Yaakov, you think about Hebron. You don't think about Be'er Sheva. But he used to really spend a lot of time in Be'er Sheva. In fact, that's where he spent a chunk of his time. In fact, it's a little strange, I guess. But I have a cousin who he lives in Be'er Sheva, and they made a bris in Be'er Sheva, and everybody made a big deal about it. Yer Avraham. And they're going, what, Yer Avraham? That's true. Be'er Sheva was Yer Avraham. I mean, just don't think of. I guess prejudice. Somebody lives closer to Hebron than to Be'er Sheva. But anyways, I live closer to Hebron than Be'er Sheva. In any event, why? So he could be going to Be'er Sheva. He could be going anywhere. Why does Rashi say towards Yerushalayim? So here the Rav said that Rashi is supplementing the story by telling us it's a deeper truth than just Avraham Avinu's travelogue. He says as follows. He said, you know, Jewish life is such that we live in different dimensions. In other words, a Jew who's in touch with his inner soul and his inner personality is aware of the fact that he doesn't just live in this world. He has to live in this world. But he has to live as well. He lives in different dimensions of reality. And one of the things that Jews have is they have a very intense and very keen radar for Kedusha, for sanctity. He sometimes doesn't even know that that's what draws him, but Jews are automatically drawn to Kedusha. They're drawn to justice, they're drawn to mercy, but they're especially drawn to Kedusha. And Kedusha is not just a prayer in Chazar Sashatz. Kedusha is an experience. It's a moment which you feel. It's a moment that you know. You see something which is, you see, you're in a makom kadosh, you're in a sacred place. You know there's something about it, but you can't just put your finger on it. But you know, you have a sixth sense, as it were, that there is another dimension of reality, a higher dimension, a special dimension of reality in this place, which you can't describe. There's a fancy English word for that. It's called ineffable. It's indescribable. It's just something that you have and you can't wrap your head around it, but you can wrap your heart around it. So the Rav said, that's what Rashi's trying to tell us. That Avraham Avinu wasn't just on a real estate gig. It wasn't one of these deals where he's looking to check out the best location for where he's going to live and what part of this territory God was giving him, although that was part of it too. But he was looking for Kedusha. He was looking for the source. And the source was first Yerushalayim. But at the source of Yerushalayim is Har HaBayit, because Har HaBayit is a place which is Kadosh. It was a place where the world began. It's the world place where all elements of the world coalesce. It's interesting, there's a... He proves it from a number of different things. I'll give you an example. There's a Mishnah in Masechet Kelim. It's not one of the Masechtot of the Mishnayos that you would normally read on a regular basis. It says that there were 10 levels of sanctity in Eretz Yisrael. Okay, from the outer skirts of Eretz Yisrael, as you get closer and closer to Yerushalayim, and then in Yerushalayim to the Har HaBayit, and Har HaBayit and Beis HaMikdash, that keeps going and going and going until you get to the Holy of Holies, to the Kodesh HaKadoshim, which is sitting under, at the moment, the place of the Kodesh HaKadoshim is sitting underneath the Dome of the Rock today. They built that right smack on top of where the most important part of the Beis HaMikdash was. So what did the Rav derive from that? The Rav from this Mishnah derived from the fact that that the source of all Kedusha is the place where the Shekhinah indwells, and according to the Rambam, it's still there. And then it infuses, it sort of radiates out to the rest of Eretz Yisrael, meaning that all of Eretz Yisrael, the Kedusha of all of Eretz Yisrael, ultimately, is an extension of the Beis HaMikdash. It's the source of all, well, God is the source of all Kedusha, but God's presence on the Har HaBayit is, in fact, according to the Rambam, the source of all the Kedusha in Eretz Yisrael. And people who come, people are riveted on Eretz Yisrael, Davka, because of its special Kedusha, because this country, this land lives, exists on a different dimension of reality. When I first heard the Rav give this whole long discussion, was in the 70s. So it's a little bit, so what he has to say, had to say at the time was a little bit dated today. But he said, I remember him saying, why do Jews who've never been here, I mean here to Israel, why do they care? Why are they so obsessed with the land of Israel? They're never going to see it. Or maybe they want, maybe they will, maybe they won't. But they care. Why do they care? Because the Jew inherently knows that this is a place that of special, first of all, special status for him as a Jew, but also because this is the source of all Kedusha. The whole world depends on, all of Jewish people certainly depend on what happens here. Now that's not just a Zionist raid, that's a halacha. Okay, I'll give you two examples, or give you an important example, all right? There is a din, we'll talk about it a little bit more in depth when we get to Parshat Bo, maybe. There is a rule that, how do you know what today's Hebrew, what's today's Hebrew day? Let's do it that way. Anybody know? There are people in this country, by the way, who organize themselves around the Hebrew dates. No, today was your Dalit. Tonight is Teshuvah. But that's okay. If you take a look. That's, by the way, what day of the month it is should be a no-brainer, because you just have to walk outside and take a look at the gorgeous moon, and you'll know it's a full moon tonight, so it's the 15th of Mar Cheshvan. Yafeh. Okay? How do you know that? How do you know what the Hebrew day is? How would you know what the Hebrew day is? How do we figure it out?
The cycle
of the moon. No. Originally, we're supposed to. Okay, originally we're supposed to have two witnesses and come to the Sanhedrin, and they say when the new moon is, and they declare it's the new moon, and that they send out, and then they send out faxes. No, there were no faxes. They send out riders, they send out signals, or whatever the case may be, to tell the world that in fact it's going to be the new moon. Yafet. But we don't have a Sanhedrin anymore, and there are no more Adim and whatever. So how do we know?
Calendar.
The calendar. What's the calendar based on? The calendar is not, the calendar is, that's true, but the calendar is based on a mathematical formula, which is known as the Sod HaYibur, the secret formula. You know, we have a secret formula in Coke, so a secret formula here. How to organize, how to calculate the calendar. Okay, yafe. Now the rule is that when the calendar was calculated or was set based on the witnesses, the testimony of witnesses and so on, okay, that the entire procedure had to happen in the land of Israel, okay? And if it didn't happen, the individual didn't count. Under extraordinary circumstances, you could, if things were totally wacky and there were no qualified rabbanim in Israel, so then you could maybe go outside the country to do it. But in principle, had to be done here. Could anything, in other words, if all the greatest rabbis in the world lived in, a bunch of great rabbis lived in Poland or lived in New York or lived in, I don't know, Oshkosh, wherever it is, and they decided how the calendar would look, what they did wouldn't count. Had to be done here in Eretz Yisrael. Okay? Yafeh. The question is, okay, but we don't have a Sanhedrin anymore. There's no Sanhedrin in Chutz La'aretz anymore either. So we have a, so there's no Sanhedrin, there's no witnesses. We have the calendar. Everybody can fit there, and all the butchers and all the funeral homes and all the shuls, they all have calendars, they print this and them out, and their advertisements, and they tell you what time, when Wendy Wasserman's bar mitzvah is, and when Ronald Goldman's bar mitzvah is, and when so-and-so's yahrzeit is, and when the shul dinner is, and when you have to get the ads in. I mean, everybody knows where the calendar is. So maybe you don't, so it should be so obvious, so it makes sense. That mathematics you can do anywhere you want. All the good apps are done by Rusty Brick somewhere in, I assume it's someplace in New York or New Jersey. So, anybody knows what Rusty Brick is?
No.
That's like all the cool apps on your iPhone, like the Rusty Brick Sitter that you like. You never saw the Rusty Brick Sitter? The Rusty Brick Sitter, here it is, my sitter. And it gives you Misha Berachs, and it gives you all kinds of stuff, and it adjusts to whatever day it is. So on Chol HaMoed, it chucks in Yalav Yavo, and... And on Rosh Chodesh it kicks in Yalav Yavo and Musaf and Chatzi Hallel and Chanukah Chol Hallel and Alanisim and anyways, so all the fancy stuff can be done anywhere in the world. It can be done in America, it can be done in Canada, it can be done in Antarctica, it doesn't matter. So maybe Eretz Yisrael is relevant to the calendar now. Rambam says nothing doing. Rambam says that even though we use the calendar, we use this mathematical formula called the Sod HaYidur to calculate the calendar, the truth of the matter is that from a legal point of view, what authorizes the calendar is the presence of Jews in the land of Israel who continue to follow that mathematical formula. The Rambam says, if God forbid there were no Jews in Israel, there would be no calendar. Because at the end of the day, the Jews who live in Eretz Israel, they're the true Am Yisrael, and everybody else is dependent on our presence. But the Rambam says explicitly in two places. He says it in the Sefer Mitzvahs, and he says it in Hilchos Kiddush Hashanah. We'll look at the passages of Mitzvahs from inside further on. Point is what? It's another one of these things where with this riveting dependence upon the land of Israel is another expression of this idea that the Makom HaMikdash, that the Hashkachas HaShechinah is on Har Moriah, and that radiates out and infuses all of Eretz Israel and makes it a place which is like a magnet for Jewish attention and caring in ways that are absolutely really beyond things. The truth of the matter is, I was thinking the other day about the intensity of anti-Jewish activity. The intensity of an anti-Jewish activity by Jews in the world. It's enormous. The most vicious anti-Zionists are all Jews. Okay? Now, if you're talking about Satmar Jews, you understand a little bit, because they really feel that people who come and settle in Israel and support the state are diabolic, and they're the worst kind of sinners, because they're literally defying God. On the part of everybody else, the assimilated Jews or Jews who aren't that, you know, aren't in that head, so what do they care? For example, for many, many, many years, there was a terrible civil war going on in Ireland between the Protestants and the Catholics. It's still not totally settled, but it's a lot better than it used to be. Okay? I grew up with a lot of Irish kids, and they were interested in Ireland, but it wasn't to the degree, they weren't so obsessed with Ireland and what was going on as Jews are obsessed with what goes on in Israel, even if they oppose it. So you begin to wonder, like, this is like the, you know what I mean, like sort of like the inverse side of things, like why do they care? It's sort of like the dark side of the force in terms of your response to the charisma of the land of Israel. But ech shelo yiyeh. The Rav's position was that that Israel just exerts an incredible hold on us because of the fact that it has such Kedusha, and Jews have this sort of extra sense for Kedusha, how you interpret it, how you use it. That actually pops up, interestingly, in this week's Parsha as well. Take a look in the story of the Akedah, actually. Take a look on here. It's Perek Kafbet. Pasuk Gimel. Okay? God says to Avraham Avinu, the Akedah is this topic we can talk about like forever and ever and ever. What is this? God decides to tell Avraham Avinu to sacrifice his son. It'll take us far afield at the moment. I want to zoom in on just one point, which is related to what we've been talking about. In Pasuk Gimel, Vayashkeim Avraham Baboker. So Avraham Avinu gets up in the morning, early in the morning. Vayachavoshet Hamoro, and he saddles up his donkey. Vayikach et Shnei Naravito, and he takes his two retainers with him. Ve'et Yitzchak Beno, and his son. And his son Yitzchak, vayivaka atzeolad, he chopped up some wood to put on the altar to burn the offering. Vayakam vayelech al makom asher amar lo Elokim, and he goes to the place where God had told him. Okay. Now, one of the interesting things over here is, and that's what I forgot to mention before, does God ever tell Avraham Avinu where he's going when he leaves Haran? He says, Lech lecha me'artzacha mimolatacha mi'beit avicha el ha'artz she'areka. He doesn't tell him where he's going. He doesn't give him a GPS, and he doesn't give him a map. He just says, go. I'll show you. But you have to, in Yiddish, you say he has to vulgar sich. He has to wander around trying to figure it out. What's the point? Rashi's telling us, in this Rashi I just mentioned, that his GPS was what? He was going with his tuition. Okay, let's go back. Have you seen Star Wars? One, right? Okay, so it's using the force. Use your feelings. Reach out with your... In words, he's not going with his mind. He's going with his feelings, sort of drawn to the place he's supposed to go. And Rashi, in this comment that we just saw, is a matter of that's how he got, in fact, to Eretz Yisrael Bichlal. Was by following this internal GPS, this draw to a place of Kedusha. The same thing's happening over here. He says, go to Eretz HaMoriah. Eretz HaMoriah is a big place, guys. Eretz HaMoriah is a lot of mountains. There's just around Yerushalayim. There is Har Tzion, and Har HaMoriah, and Har HaEtzot HaRa'ot, and Har HaZeitim, and Har HaTzofim, and Har... I mean, there's a ton of them. How does he know which mountain? What the Torah tells us, Vayelech LaMakom Asher Amar Elohim, he went to the region that God had told him. Nobody had told him. And that's why Rashi in Pasuk Dalet, that's the important Pasuk, Pasuk Dalet Hey, actually. Bayom HaShlishi, took him 3 days. By the way, where was he leaving from? He was probably leaving from Chevron, which means he was walking north on Kvish Shishim, the road. You've all been to the Gush. Okay, so the road, the main road that goes from the Gush to Yerushalayim, it's not exactly that road, because the actual road is a little bit up on the hill. It cuts across near Neve Daniel and Elazar. Walking up that road towards Yerushalayim, through Beit Lechem, and he comes to probably where the Tayelet, where the promenade is, okay, in East Talpiot. And he gets to that place, he looks over, he sees all these mountains, Vayara Tamakom Merachok, and he sees the place from afar. So Rashi says, but still got a lot of mountains there. So good. Rashi says, what did he see? How did he know which mountain we were talking about? So Rashi says, Ra'a anan kashur lahar. He saw a cloud hovering or attached, more probably hovering is a better translation, hovering over the mountain. Okay? Vayomaraj Avraham el Ne'arav. And so he said to his two retainers, who according to Chazal were whom? Who did he go with? Who were the two kids that came with him, or two people came with him? Yishmael and Eliezer were his attendants, and he took Yitzchak. And he had two Na'arim, and he brought Yitzchak. Okay? Yafir. So there were the four of them. Vayomer Avraham el Ne'arav, Shvu lechem po em achamor. You stay here, po, with the donkey. Vaniva Na'ar, and I and the young man, meaning Yitzchak, Nelcha ad ko. We'll go over there. V'nishtachave v'nashuva alechem. And we'll go over there. Okay. Now, the Rav pointed out that when he speaks to the Na'arim, Avram says, you stay po, and my son and I will go ko. So the Medrash, here the Rav quoted, the Rashi doesn't quote the Medrash, but here the Medrash, there's a Medrash the Rav invoked. The Medrash in Bereishis Rabba says, that he asked, when they got to the Tayelet, they got to the promenade, the share of a promenade, and he asked them, what do you see? So they said, what do you mean what I see? I see mountains. And he asked Eliezer, I see mountains. And he asked Ishmael, what do you see? He says, I don't know, I see a mountain. And he said to Yitzchak, what do you see? He says, I see a mountain over there that has a cloud hovering over it. At which point Avraham Avinu understood that Eliezer and Yishmael, they live in the here and now. They live in the po. They live in here and now. They see mountains, they can function, they're certainly, you know, well-adjusted, well, Yishmael, but individuals, but they're limited to what they can see and what they can feel and what they can prove and what they can handle that's concrete. We're living in a concrete universe. Yitzchak, he understood, saw what he saw. You see what I see. He says, Yitzchak also saw the Anana Kashur Lahar. He also saw the mountain, that, sorry, the cloud that was hovering over the mountain. In other words, he saw there was another dimension of things. He saw that there was a light, that there was a, there was someplace else to strive for. And the Rav said the difference between Yitzchak, between Avraham and Yitzchak and them was the fact that Jews live in the Po. We live in the here and now. We're not Christian monks or Catholic monks or Orthodox monks, or certain types of Sufi. We don't withdraw from the world. But we also, at the same time, have a dimension of seeing worlds that haven't yet been created, of dimensions of reality that transcend the here and now, of considerations that go beyond reason and go beyond our understanding, and we go with faith. By all, the truth of the matter is, and again, this is not just a schmooze. From a historical, I'm a trained historian. Okay, there is no reasonable, in my opinion, his professional opinion, there is no reasonable explanation for the existence of the Jewish people today. Now, I'm not the first person to notice that. Rabbi Yehuda Levi and Ramban and others pointed out that we just play by different rules. We live in the here and now, and we play by a different historical causality. It was the capacity to be able to. And so what was this cloud? This cloud was basically God manifesting himself in the world. This little cloud hovering over a little mountain. There are mountains that are higher than the Temple Mount, by the way. The mountain on which the Jewish quarter is built is higher than the Temple Mount. So is Har Tzion. So is Har Zeitim. So is Har Tzofim. So is Har Ha'itzot HaRa'ot, which is the mountain opposite, right next to Har Zeitim. But there was this little, so you have this little cloud hovering over this little mountain. It's a bump. And there was something special about it, which Avraham Avinu saw, and which Yitzchak Avinu saw, and the others didn't. Because there were dimensions of reality which we live with and other people don't see. And our existence, in fact, is dependent upon seeing that. Because by all the other rules, we shouldn't be here. In fact, there's a very dear friend of mine. His name is Simcha Gold, Professor Simcha Golden, Tel Aviv University, has a book that he wrote about the Jewish community in the Middle Ages in France and Germany. So the book is called Hayachid V'Hayachad. Hayachid V'Hayachad, the individual and togetherness. But the subtitle is called The Enigma of Jewish Survival in the Middle Ages. Yeah, it's an enigma, which means something you can't figure out under normal circumstances. So this capacity on the part of Yitzchak Avinu to see the cloud in Avraham Avinu hooks in with the same sixth sense for Kedusha with which Rashi starts prefaces Avraham Avinu's wanderings from Haran, first from Ur Kasdim and then from Haran, and from Haran to Eretz Yisrael, to Yerushalayim, to Har Moriah, which was its target. Same thing over here. Okay, so that was point number one. Point number two, it's going to be a throwaway. Maybe we'll talk about it on another occasion, but I can't not mention it in this connection. One of the things that people like to point out with regard to the story of the Akedah is that it was perfectly acceptable in the time of Avraham Avinu to sacrifice your children. Now, I know that sounds horrific, okay? And it is horrific. Obviously, the psychological makeup of parents at the time was very different than their attitude towards children were very different. And I'm not saying they didn't love their children, but obviously you had to have your head organized differently to be able to do something like that. And it's not the first. Many people argue that in fact that was the test. It's sort of, from our point of view, a terrible test. But that was the test. In other words, as if God was coming to say, Avraham Avinu, just like everybody else, I gave you a kid, now you have to offer it just like everybody else. And Avraham Avinu goes and does it, tries to do it. And in the end, God says, no, I don't want that. And the whole point, according to many, is to say that one of the functions, one of the lessons of the Akedah story, we don't believe in child sacrifice. We don't believe in human sacrifice. Okay? Yafeh. Okay. Good. Rav used to like to point out, he says, just because we don't believe in human sacrifice doesn't mean we don't believe in sacrifice. I'm not talking about animals either. The nature of Jewish life is, and this is very, very not politically correct, and very, very not modern, but it's very Jewish. The nature of Jewish life is that we live a sacrificial existence. In order to serve God, God demands that we give up stuff. We get stuff, and as I said, nobody says we have to give up everything in the world and give up all your... I mean, among Christians, among Catholics at least, the big deal was the priests live in poverty. They don't... The church is richest Croesus, but priests and monks don't, and nuns, they officially don't own anything. Okay, the idea is to have nothing and to live on nothing. And all the great saint stories in the Catholic Church are all about people giving away things. And in fact, it's even true. I mean, it's not true of evangelical mega ministers, but the average, the average big Protestant minister, it's not for nothing that we say that somebody was as poor as a church mouse. They live very, very, modestly. Because having stuff is not a good thing, according to the Catholic Church. Having money, having property, having wealth. We don't believe in that. We believe that you can have stuff. On the other hand, we are bidden to sacrifice. We sacrifice where we can eat, and what we can eat, and where we can go, and when we can go, and what we can do with our time, and what we can do with our wealth, and what we can do with ourselves, and where we can reach to raise our children, and where we can live. We sacrifice in terms of when we can have relations with our husbands or our wives. Sometimes, the greatest heroic feat is an act of surrender, of defeat, of sacrifice. We live a sacrificial existence. So just because the idea of human sacrifice is an anathema to us, doesn't mean that we don't sacrifice. We sacrifice plenty for God, because that's what God demands of us. He gives us stuff, and He says, "Give next to tzedakah." It's funny, the difference in charity and tzedakah. Why you can't translate tzedakah as charity? What's tzedakah mean? What's it mean? What's the word mean? What's the word come from? Righteousness, justice. It means thou must. It's not a matter of, tzedakah is not an option. What does the word charity mean? Well, this is where you get information you wouldn't get anywhere else. Certainly not in your normal or your typical seminary during your gap year. Okay? The word charity, if there was an eraser here, hopefully there was an eraser here. The word charity, is the English version of a Latin word which is caritas. Okay? Caritas is the Latin translation of a Greek word. I think I got Greek today. Agape. And agape is probably as close a translation of the word chesed as you can get. Now, the word agape pops up in the New Testament. What do you think you're going to get a New Testament lesson today? In the New Testament, the founder of Christianity is constantly talking about you have to live for I. It comes up in Paul's letters too. Agape. I love you for love. Christians are always into love. Okay, a love really means the translation really means chesed. In other words, you should if you want to do something right with other people, for other people, you have to have chesed. You have to not just sympathize, but empathize with them. You have to feel their feeling, and that should be the motivating factor for your actions. In other words, so therefore, chesed becomes agape, caritas, charity. In other words, ultimately, charity means chesed. What does that mean? That means that if I'm going to give charity, if I'm going to give something to someone in need, it's not a matter of God said, I gave you money, you must give part of that, if not all of it, to, well, you can't give all of it, you know, I'll be then you're not allowed to give all of it. But give a chunk of it to a person because he deserves it, because that's my will, that's your obligation to give the money. Okay? If you work on the basis of agape, it means it only work or charity, it's when I care, it's when I feel so bad for the person that I'll give them. There's a difference. Stucka says, you give the money whether you want it or not, whether you like the money or not. Agape says, unless you can feel for that person, feel your bleeding heart, then you give the money. Otherwise, forget it. Otherwise, your act is not that valuable. Maybe not valuable at all. I'll give you an example. Okay? Anybody ever watch the way that Protestant Christian America has always raised money for good causes is a perfect example of how this works. Okay? Did you ever watch the Jerry Lewis telethon, which is still going on even though he must be like 180 years old? Did you ever watch it? It's always on Labor Day. It goes on for 3 days. He raises money for muscular dystrophy. Obviously not for muscular dystrophy, for muscular dystrophy research. You never watched? You've watched. Through the course of this telethon, okay, maybe they don't have it anymore, but through the course of this telethon, all kinds of kids, especially kids, in wheelchairs, and on crutches, come marching in, and they talk about how this helps them, so on. And the idea is you see these kids, and your heart goes out to them. So of course you're going to write a check, or call them your current account number. Okay? But Jerry Lewis happens to be Jewish. But it's a very Christian way of doing this. You take these poor people, you put them on the stage, and you get people to feel bad for them, and then you give money. That's not stuck. I mean, in my opinion, it's actually an abuse of these people and embarrassing them. Why do they have to? What's the highest level of stuck? One of the highest levels of stuck is that you don't know who you're giving to, and they don't know who's giving them. It's humiliating. Get up there and show off your. And by the way, this is not just Jerry Lewis. In the 19th century, when the rich robber barons, you know, the rich New York families, the Blue Book. You know about the Blue Book? This was all these fancy people, the Vanderbilts and the Guggenheims and all these museums that you've heard about, and the Roosevelts and the Astors and the all these fancy schmancy rich waspy types. They would have major get-togethers to raise money for the poor of New York, and they would bring a few poor people to the dinner. Not that they should have a meal, well, maybe that was part of the idea too, but so you should see them, you should have rachmanis, and you should give money. It's like advertising for the money. Like, okay, it's like you know, those paintings of the kids with the big eyes. That's caritas. By us, yes, there's chesed, you feel bad for someone, you do for them, it's certainly true, but stocke, is something else. Stuck is a matter of you are commanded to sacrifice. You're commanded to take your money and to give it. Now, this is probably not a mitzvah midoraisa of giving 10%. It's probably a midas chasidus. It's probably something which is over and beyond what's required. But to give stuck is not an option. It's a mitzvah. It's a mitzvah like saying Kriyishma in the morning and then not cheating on your taxes. In any event, the point is that how do we come to that? So there is a concept of sacrifice. It's just not human sacrifice. We are required to. Not everything is for us. It's not always about you. It's not always about us. It's not always about being comfortable. Modern society has a tendency to be very interested in avoiding discomfort and worrying about number one first. That is not a Jewish way. Yes, worrying about number one, you shouldn't hurt yourself and whatever, but the idea that something shouldn't pinch, something should be, you do something that's not, you do something even though it's inconvenient, if it's a matter of tzedek, if it's a matter of chesed, whatever, absolutely not. Okay. Those are the two comments, sort of like preliminary comments. In the time that we have left, I want to share with you some insights that the Rav had in terms of what was it that Avraham Avinu achieved? What was it that he What was the background against which he worked and his personality developed, and what kind of image does he present for us? Because at the end of the day, and this is another piece, I mentioned this a couple of weeks ago, maybe actually in the first year. You've heard of Jewish time. We've talked about this a little bit. What's Jewish time mean? Jewish time. No? You never heard the expression Jewish time? Jewish time generally means it happens late. Okay, so for example, Israel, because it's a Jewish country, works on Jewish time more than any other place. But I'll give you an example. Okay, if you ever get invited to a wedding while you're here, okay, somebody gets married, invited to the wedding. If it says the chuppah will be promptly at 7, that means that they probably won't even open up the tables at 7. It's never promptly at anything. I remember the first wedding I ever went to said the chuppah will be properly at 7:30. I remember we were living in Yerushalayim and the wedding was in Bat Yam, and we had made an early Purim Suda so we could go right into Bat Yam. I didn't even have a car at the time, went by bus, got there on time, and there's nobody there. People start dripping in dribbling in like an hour later. So everything's always, that's Jewish. That's the joke is that's Jewish time. Jewish time in our sense is something totally different than what the Rebbe was talking about. There are two types of time. There's chronological time, that's clock time, in which what happens? The time goes by and the past is not retrievable. It's gone. I mean, the moment that I started this year an hour ago, hour or so ago, it's gone. Finished. Can't get back. Can't take it back. It's done. Okay? It's done. Mada hava hava. What happened, happened. The future is also not here. We're always living in the present. And that's also very fleeting. Okay. So that's chronological. That's not chronological. That's chronometric time. That's time of the clock. Okay? Yes, sir. According to that theory, the past is dead and the future is unattainable. Because it's always just ahead of you. Jewish time teaches that the past and the future are alive. This is a very, very, very important part of Jewish spirituality and of how we function. Okay? There is no dead past. Okay? For example. Okay? Did you go to Kfar Rachel last week?
In the beginning.
There were 80,000 people. I mean, later in the week, it was crazy. Okay? Were you alone there, or were there other people there? Were there like little old ladies there?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Those little old ladies taught me, one of them taught me. I was sort of like, what I'm about to tell you, in terms of the Rav Soloveitchik used to say, I hadn't really seen it so up close as when I first went to Kfar Rachel, and it was not as big. It was a very modest building at the time. This is 40 years ago. Now it's this big fortress. But the little Yerushalmi ladies who sit there taught me a lesson. If you listen, if you watch them, okay, next time you go, you should pay attention. They talk to Rachel Imenu like she was their best friend. They tell Mama Rachel their problems, and they ask Mama Rachel to do things for them, to intercede with the Kaddish Baruch Hu for them, and they ask Mama Rachel if somebody's not having trouble having a child, then maybe she could intercede with the Kaddish Baruch Hu. I mean, they talk to Mama Rachel like I'm talking to you. Now, if I were a psychiatrist, I would say, these people are crazy. She died. When did she die? She died, well, let's figure out. 16, how much is 16 and 21? 3,700 years ago? I mean, she's not listening. So Chaira, right? She's dead. This is a grave. All right? It's not even a grave, it's somebody they knew. When people go to a cemetery and they talk to the person who died, it's a person they know. But these little old Yerushalmi ladies sit and they talk to Mama Rachel like, Mama's the next step. Which means that for them, Mama Rachel, Rachel Imenu, really is alive. She's a living, tangible figure in their lives. They experience Rachel Imenu. Her life speaks to them. even though she lived 3,700 years ago. Or more, 3,750. If Avraham Avinu was dated around 1,800. More than that, all the people in our past are people that we can identify with and talk to, or at least empathize with. They're not people who died. They fill a place in our lives with Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Moshe, David, whoever it is. Some people have favorites, some people who don't. Because the past is accessible. We are bidden by the Torah to re-experience it, to transcend the moment. Okay, the whole Pesach HaGadah is based on that, but that's just part of it. So Avraham Avinu is not just a person who died, you know, if he's just a person who died 3,900 years ago, so who would care? How many of you, okay, you live in the United States, okay? The two formative individuals who created the United States are George Washington and Abraham Lincoln. Who's been to Washington's grave at Mount Vernon? Have you? I've been, actually. Have you? Do you feel a need to go? No. Who's been to Lincoln's grave in Springfield, Illinois? These are guys, it's more than the dollar bill and the $5 bill. These are people who really created the world in which you live. Who goes? Excuse me. Who's been to Arlington National Cemetery? You've been to Kennedy's grave? Okay. One out of seven. There is something about, but God forbid, a person loses a parent or a child or a spouse, they go. Why? Because that's a person they can relate to. They feel the need. So obviously, and tens of thousands of people go to Kevar Rachel and to Maarat HaMachpelah and to whatever the case might be. Now, I'm not the biggest fan of the subculture of running around to graves in Israel. I think we should live with the living and not so much with the dead. But there is something to this, but it's only if it speaks to you. So Avraham Avinu is an individual who is formative. And that's one of and the sense of tangible past, of accessible past, is one of the things that's kept us alive. Otherwise, our memories would have been gone and we wouldn't have existed. So the idea, trying to understand Avraham Avinu is not just a function of learning Torah, which is a big mitzvah, but it's also a matter of trying to understand an individual who has a direct impact on us today, right now, who speaks to us. Now everybody has their favorites. I'm actually a Moshe bigger. I'm a bigger Moshe fan than Avraham Avinu fan. Other people have other people. I mean, I'm not putting anybody down. But you have certain people you speak to that speak to you. The rabbis tell a story that in 1938, they marked the 800th anniversary of the birth of the Rambam, and they asked him to give a paper at Harvard, which he did, but he made a joke. He says, you know, I was really stunned when I discovered that they were having this thing in honor of the 800th anniversary of the Rambam, because I didn't know that the Rambam had died, because every day of his life he would study Rambam. So he's a living, breathing personality. And the nature of Talmud Torah is like that. When we talk about, when we quote Mefarshim and Chumash, how do we quote them? Rashi says. What do you mean says? Rashi died over 900 years ago. But we do it in front. The Rambam says. Shulchan Aruch says. The Ramban says. Because they're living individuals. Shakespeare wrote. Longfellow wrote. The Vilna Gaon says. It's a very significant. These little. What's the word? Grammatical little foibles are very indicative. Sometimes you can actually learn more from a little detail than you can from a very big principle. Okay. All right. So, let's start. I will finish this mitzvah next week, but let's start. The Rambam, Maimonides in the Mishneh Torah, grapples with the question of how is it that people came to worship the stars and the moon and the sun and the moon and the winds and the spirits and all kinds of stuff, and how did they get 3 billion gods? Have any of you ever been to Rome? Okay. In the center of Rome is a building called the Pantheon. Pantheon means all the gods. It was built by a very close friend of Augustus Caesar, whose name was Marcus Agrippa, who may or may not have been murdered by Augustus' wife Livia later on. That's not important. The Pantheon, all the gods, was intended to be a place in which all the gods that are worshipped in the Roman Empire could find representation and a home. So when you go into, it's now a church, but when you go in, this huge dome, enormous, it's a huge building. It's across the street, it's actually across from the, it's right across the way from the, what's called the Trevi Fountain, which is where the original, throw a penny in and you'll get your wish. So it's right across the Trevi Fountain. You go in this huge dome, and the dome, instead of like being just having ribs and being smooth, has little niches, like zillions and gazillions of little niches all around the wall. And then at one time, all of those niches had these little idols, little gods. So how do you get to 3 billion? I mean, there are quizillion number of gods there. So the Rambam is struck by, how do you get to that? How do we get to having a gazillion number of gods? How did Avodah Zarah develop that this is what happened? So the Rambam assumed, I'm gonna summarize his theory. The Rambam said, look, Adam HaRishon knew there was one God. So how'd you go from believing in one God to believing in 3 billion gazillion gods? So he said like this. He said the issue was like this. So what happened was, he said that at some stage of the ballgame, after Adam, I'm going to put in my own two cents. I think it was a matter of they couldn't like wrap their heads around the idea that there was one God, he's in charge of everything, and he's everywhere, he knows everything. So, whatever, they got the idea that the world is really beautiful. Well, that's true. The world is really beautiful. There's been some incredible sunsets lately. If you've noticed, the world is really beautiful, and God made the world. So maybe God would like it if not only we were grateful to him, but we praised his creations too. We sang a song of praise to the sun and the moon and the stars and the trees. Because, for example, okay, when the Secretary of State comes calling, it actually doesn't happen so much anymore, but during the 90s, when they were constantly doing all kinds of peace, this, that, and the other thing, Jerusalem was inundated with dignitaries and secretaries of this and secretaries of that and ministers of that and this and that and everything. And every time, and in fact, they would close off streets, and when Clinton came, they blocked off half of the street that I was living on because he was staying at the LeBron. It's not the list. It's called not the LeBron anymore. It's called the Union Bowl, and whatever. And they would deck out the whole city would be decked out with flags. Whatever country was visiting, whether it was Russia or France or England, the United States, and whatever. In fact, they used to, and you couldn't get, and traffic would be was snarled up, and you couldn't, and the buses were rerouted. In fact, there was an old Yerushalmi expression in Ra'ita Degel Lech Beregel. If you see a flag, go by foot, because you're never going to get anywhere otherwise, anyways. When the Secretary of State comes. Secretary of State comes and you give her and you honor her or him sometimes. All right. So who are you honoring? You honoring the person per se, or what? What are you actually doing? You're honoring the government that sent the representative, or you're honoring the head of that government. So when a king sends his ambassador, for example, okay, what's the rule of extraterritoriality? When you go to, have you been to the American consulate in America, in Israel, in Gilo? No reason to go. Not in Gilo, in Talpiot. Okay? When you walk in there, you are legally in the United States. Okay? Embassies, by definition, consulates are exterritorial, meaning that they are not part of the country in which they are found geographically. They are legally part of the United States. So therefore, if an American citizen is in Dutch with, for whatever reason, being chased by the local authorities, he makes it to the American embassy, he makes it to the American consulate, he is safe. He can't be touched, he's home. Now, how they'll get him home is another story. But as long as he's in the compound, he's safe. All right? Why? Because that represents the United States. If you hit an ambassador, or if you kill an ambassador, like the guys did in Benghazi not long ago, you have not only attacked the ambassador, you have physically attacked the United States of America, because he represents, he embodies the United States of America. Okay? So similarly, they said, gee, you know, the creations of God represent him, so I'll praise them. And then that'll be, God will like that. All right, that was stage one. That was the beginning of the end. Next, he said, they decided that they were going to, they were going to write poems and prayers to the sun and the moon and the stars and all this other stuff and make sacrifices, and that God would like that because we're being nice. It's like taking the Secretary of State out to dinner. You don't take her out for falafel, you take her out to, I don't know, Darna, or you take her out to I don't even know the expensive restaurants in Weimar anymore. You take a Papagayo, I don't know, wherever you take her, she likes it. Okay? That was stage one. Stage two is where prophets come and speak in the name of God, and they say, you know what? False prophets, obviously. You know what? I want you to worship certain idols, certain gods, certain stars and stuff. And I'll tell you how to do it, do this, this, and this. In other words, they're taking God's name and saying, that authorizes me to worship. I'm telling you the name of God's name, you should worship idols. Okay? And then, later on, God fell out of the whole deal, and prophets came and said, the idol, the star, sun, whatever it is, told me that in fact, it is time. It's time. We worship idols. Okay. There you go. And at that point, says the Rambam, at that point he said, "Avaltsur ha'olamim, the master of the universe, the rock of the ages, lo ayashum adam shayam makiro." They got so sidetracked with the idols. They got so sidetracked with their fancy ritual, with worshiping and adoring the creation. They forgot. They lost all concept of the Creator. V'lo yod'o, and nobody knew him. Eli yichidim ba'olam, except certain unique individuals in the world, like Hanoch and Metushelach, Noach, Shem and Ever. Val derech hazeh haya ha'olam holechu mitgalgel. And the world continued to deteriorate, or to roll downhill, ad shenolad amudo shel olam, until was born the pillar of the world, the one who stopped, put the brakes on this, v'hu Avraham Avinu. The point is that people, out of the goodness, out of their own innocence, ended up substituting the real thing. I'm sorry, the other way around. Substituting the end, the means with the end. They end up worshiping God's creations and forgetting about the Creator. Now, in a deeper level, we'll come to this, I'll complete this next week, but at a deeper level, this is not just a problem with the Avraham Avinu. We have a serious problem in Orthodox Judaism, and that is that sometimes we worship the thing and we miss the point. The Rav was very, very saddened and emphatic about the fact that people get they forget, they do so many, that they're so punctilious about mitzvahs, they forget about HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That they do things by rote, but they miss the point. That they'll daven, but God's not part of it. That can be a form of idolatry as well. I always like to tell a story about, there was a, it was a time that I gave, I speak a lot, but there was a time that I used to give public shiur on a Shabbos afternoon in a certain community. And there'd be like 200, 300 people who come every week. And it was made very clear to me that I better not go a minute after Havdalah because people have to run. And I remember thinking, there's something wrong. I mean, I don't want to go over time and take people's time, but there's something wrong when adding on to the Kedusha of Shabbos into the week, which is a mitzvah, is wrong. It's, no, don't do that. You know, I'll do what I have to do, but I'm not going to do one more thing. There's something missing. There's a comment by the Izbitzer Rebbe, the Meshiloach, I didn't see it inside, but somebody quoted it to me a while ago, that people who are very punctilious in mitzvahs, but that's all they know how to do is say exactly the amount of matzah and exactly the amount of choresis and exactly the amount of this and that and the other thing, and your children are absolutely, according to all the shitas, they will have a place in the world to come as a bench. There's something not vivifying about that. Now, I'm not saying, of course, you have to be makbid mitzvahs, kalak hakamura, but it's got to be infused with the real thing. Okay, the proof of that is actually a Mishnah. But we'll leave that Mishnah for next time because time is up. So what I would ask for you to do, please, is for next time to please Xerox, I'll leave these pages, Kuf Kaf Vav, Kuf Kaf Zayin, these two pages, if you can just measure these two pages, please Xerox. Say it. My pleasure. Yeah.